Good morning, Mira, and welcome to our studio and for our listeners to say that we are honored to host today Mira Nakashima while visiting Oroville, and she will be also participating in the peace meditation tomorrow at 5 p.m. 15 at Unity Pavilion. So welcome.
Thank
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
You come in regularly to Oroville every year,
right? Oh, no, not very regularly. We came 2 years ago to dedicate the Hall of Peace, but we haven't been back since.
And you are continuing the legacy of your father, George Nakashima, who designed the peace tables from the walnut tree, yeah?
Yes. Yes, he made the first one in 1986, and we've made two since then. This is actually the second one. Mm-hmm. And it was installed in, actually, no, it's the third one.
The first one in St. John Cathedral in New York.
Yes.
Then Moscow. And then the third one in Oregon in
96,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. I remember that we had this, so to speak, peace conference around the tables on 2011. I think it was September.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
It was really nice, yeah. How do you remember your father?
I don't know, he was just my father, so I just grew up with him, and he worked at home, and now that I've been visiting different places, we just went to Ahmedabad. The reason we came this time is they had a design show of my father's work in Ahmedabad at National Institute of Design. They asked me to come and inaugurate the show and to help them set it up and so forth, and I didn't realize there was so much furniture that he had made when he was there in the 1960s. And so he created that whole show. And then when we came, they had asked my, excuse me, my associate from Japan, whom we also began work with in 1964, to come as well. And so, you know, we're still learning about my father. We're still, he's still teaching us. It's not like he's gone.
He was an amazing woodworker, but I would also say he was an artist. He was an architect, yeah?
Yes.
But that came later, you know, when he encountered the Japanese woodworkers, no?
I guess that's the way it worked, yes. He studied architecture first. I mean, he studied forestry very much in the beginning. Mm-hmm. He studied trees. Then he turned to architecture and practiced architecture for 7 years in Japan and in India. And he learned of some, when he was working in Japan, he learned from the carpenters there. But it was actually the war and the incarceration during the war that he picked up a lot of techniques of hand craftsmanship.
But it's a special craftsmanship, no?
Yes.
Because he doesn't use nails and nothing, he just used the...
The joints, the wood joinery, yes. We do use screws.
You use screws?
Yes, we do. We cover them up.
Okay. And in early years of last century, he encountered Sri Aurobindo, right?
Yes, in 1936, he came to India to work on Golconda. And he met Sri Aurobindo.
And that was an amazing thing because it was the first really concrete structure, no?
Yes, it was the first reinforced concrete building in Asia, I believe, not just India.
That's like before the Second War, no?
Yes.
Did he say anything about it? Do you remember? Did he ever talk about it?
Oh, he talked about it all the time. It was a life-changing experience. When he came in 1936, he came just as an architect. Mm-hmm. And he just got so taken with the community. At the ashram, he became a disciple in 1938 and took on the name Sundarananda. Mm-hmm. So it was a life-changing experience for him.
What about you?
How about me?
You also lead in ashram, you work with them?
Oh, no, I've never stayed there very long. I just try to follow in my dad's footsteps as best I can. Mm-hmm.
You also started the Peace Foundation, yeah, with those peace tables?
Well, no, my father actually started it in 1984 as a nonprofit organization to raise money primarily for building peace altars. But it changed recently. My mother gave, because it was a nonprofit foundation, She gave one of the buildings on the property in New Hope to the foundation, and because of that, it opened the door for receiving grants from different places. Mm-hmm. It gave us historic status. We're on the World Monument list now. We are also on a National Historic Landmark. Mm-hmm. So we have two grants in place right now to help maintain or restore the buildings. It's a wonderful thing.
That's nice. But it's also more crowded with the tourists, no?
Well, that's the problem, to keep them under control, yes.
It's just my curiosity. Do you remember when your father came across with this black walnut and start thinking about the peace tables? Oh, because it must have been, I'm pretty sure that must have been some moment somewhere where he said, okay, yeah, you see, that's what I want to continue, and that is the piece of the wood can express that, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a funny series of circumstances. Mm-hmm. There was a man who went and found great walnut trees around where we live, and he would bring them to my father, and he would sell them to my father, and he would saw them up for lumber. And one day he came in and he says, George, you won't believe this tree that I found. It's bigger and better than any other walnut tree I've ever seen in my whole life. And you need to buy it. So my father thought, what am I going to use it for? Because it's the best tree he'd ever seen in his life. And in the meantime, he had a gallbladder attack. And he had to go to the hospital. And when they were, his anesthesiologist was an Indian. I don't know if he was one of Mother's followers or not, but he put him to sleep, and when he woke up, he had this dream that's what he would make peace altars out of that log. Mm. And he purchased the log, and he had to have somebody come from California to cut it because it was too big. And so he made the first one in 1986, and he made the second one in 1995 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the UN. Mm. That one eventually went to Moscow. And the second one we made in 1996, and that came here, and it finally was found a permanent home a couple of years ago.
That's huge, you know? So how did you bring it here?
Well,
how does the transport go? It goes in two pieces because they're joined?
This one, yes, the one for India is the third one, so we learned from the first two. The first one was made in one piece, and it only went to New York City, so that wasn't too bad. We put it on a big truck, and we stopped traffic, and it got to New York all right. But going to Moscow was a major operation, and I knew it would be harder, so I made it in two parts. But the top was in one piece, and the base was in a different piece. But there was apparently only, and we didn't want to send it by land because it would be dangerous going to Russia. So we crated it, and we're waiting for the plane. I think there was only one plane on Aeroflot that was big enough to take it. So we kept waiting for this plane to be free, and it kept getting bumped back because there were other more important things to carry on this plane. So it finally got to Moscow. And we had decided, since it had to be an interfaith and non-denominational space, it couldn't be in one of those beautiful cathedrals. I was hoping it would be in one of those beautiful cathedrals, but it didn't work there.
Art museum, no?
Yeah. So now it's in now it's in an art museum. But the art museum, the spot we picked for it, had been the chapel of the original building. So I figured that this, it was a sacred space. It was okay. But they changed the space when it got there. They decided it needed to go into a different room and it wouldn't go through the door. So they cut it in two. And yes, we didn't know that. They didn't tell us until my associate went, and she went to 1 year to polish it, and she thought, this is funny, the butterflies have a line down the middle. They didn't used to have a line down the middle, so they had cut it right down the very center
and then
they put it back together again. So it was okay, and then she was in tears when she called me. She said, they've cut it in two, and I don't know what to do. And can we fix them? And I said, it's going to be really hard to fix because we would have to send somebody over and redo all the butterflies and redo the finish, and it would take a long time and very expensive.
But it's not the same anymore, no?
No, but it's part of its history. And maybe they'll have to move it again sometime. It'll be easier.
Okay.
So anyway, so that was the second one. The third one was made for India, and we had been here, and people often sit on the floor or on very low seating. So I decided I could make it lower than the first two. And also because of the transportation problem, I made it in two vertical sections, and we just put them together when it came. And it was a perfect size. It fit on trucks very easily and in airplanes very easily. And it fit perfectly on the Indian trucks even. So we were here to receive it when it came and helped uncrate it and put it back together. So.
And since 2011 is in Hall of Peace, actually the Hall the real Hall of Peace was inaugurated.
Yes.
In 2012. Yeah.
Yes, it's nice to come visit it. It's like visiting an old friend.
I heard you're gonna be also participating in tomorrow's peace meditation.
Yes.
Yeah. You've been before already, yeah? 2014, you've been here.
Yes, we were here in 2014, and Jaya and Shivaya arranged a very nice ceremony in 2014, and they've arranged a number of things also for tomorrow, so I'll just see what happens.
Amongst the others, you're going to be screening today, I think, the movie?
Will be screened this afternoon. It's still a work in progress. My cousin, John Terry, and I came to India in the year 2000 and interviewed some of the people that my father knew or people who knew Sri Aurobindo very well. And he interviewed a fair number of people at the ashram in India. And he's still, this was how many, that's 16 years ago. I think he's been working on the film for maybe 18 years. And he keeps finding more and more, researches and finds more and more information. And I think he doesn't have the heart to cut some of it out. Some of it has to be trimmed. Okay. And he doesn't want to trim it because he loves it all. So this is
epic, no?
Yeah. Well, this is an unfinished version, and I think he may have to make different versions. One for Japan. We also went to Japan in the year 2000, and interviewed a number of people who worked with my father there. So he has different interviews from Japan, and he has different interviews from India, and he interviewed some designers and design historians in America. So, I mean, there's like at least three different audiences. He was also very interested in, and he did some research on my father's experience in the camp. And during the war, when we were in the camps on the Idaho desert, my father did work alongside a Japanese carpenter who was trained in Japan and learned a lot from him while we were incarcerated. So it wasn't a total loss.
You were in concentration camp too?
Yes. I was very small, though. I don't remember much.
No, that's some people say that first memories actually they determine their life, no?
Mm-hmm.
Or shape the person.
Mm-hmm.
What about Sri Aurobindo's influence on your father?
Oh. Well, as I say, his trip to India changed his entire life. He said he was, and this came out in my cousin's film that he was my cousin does not he does not pronounce Japanese nor Sanskrit very well. So you'll have to forgive him for that. He's working on that too. He says he needs to get some teachers to help him pronounce things better. So his pronunciation is very bad, but he decided he wanted to be disciple of Sri Aurobindo. He was going to stay here the rest of his life. He'd found the answers to all his questions. He was, I guess, in his 30s. He was born in 1905. And he came here in 36. Mm-hmm. So he devoted his entire life to the mother and her work. And he called himself a karma yogi. So it did change.
So what happened? The trip to Japan, the camp, the war. What happened that he didn't stay?
Because of the war. His family was all back in the U.S. And he didn't want to leave, but he sort of had this feeling that he needed to be with his family because of the war. So he asked the mother if it was all right to leave, and she said in very, very small letters in his notebook, yes. And so there's some interesting notes after that. May I have a few rupees so I can buy gifts for my relatives when I go home? And may I have enough money to buy passage on the boat or something so we could get back? And, so she gave him enough money to get home again. But I think his heart was always here.
What about in the States when he was working? He was also mentioning or Sri Aurobindo or anything?
I don't know if he spoke to his workers, and I don't know if he spoke to my mother. He didn't speak to me particularly, but I remember growing up when I was working with him. I guess maybe I had already grown up then when I was working with him, because I didn't come back to work until 1970. But when he had people he was selling furniture to, he would always tell them about Sri Aurobindo and the mother and how Americans are too egotistic and they need to change.
Cool. And you never had a feeling that you would like to be maybe in Oroville or in Ashram?
In the back of my mind, yes. yes, but it's very difficult. And we were with Loretta today. Yeah. She brought us here. And she was saying that she worked very hard for a while in the U.S. to try to save enough money so she could retire here. Mm-hmm. And I've often thought, if I get to retire, I would probably like to retire here, but I haven't figured out how to retire yet, so I'm still working.
You're still working?
Yeah.
It's a different line. You're not employed by some kind of big company.
Yes.
There's a difference, no?
Yes.
I mean, it's also a core for our life, yeah?
Yes, right.
Your, let's say, attitude or your relationship with the wood, where are you?
Well, the reason I'm still continuing the business is when my father died, he had bought, I think, at least 100 logs, and he'd milled them up into lumber. And they were sitting in Philadelphia, and they didn't want them down there anymore. They wanted them off the property. They wanted us to take them, and we had no place to store them. And for a minute, I thought, well, maybe I'll just sell it, because I don't know what I'm going to do with all this lumber. And then I thought, well, no, because he bought those logs himself. He looked at them. He milled them. He wanted each plank of those logs to be something. So I had to figure out what those somethings were, and I had to make it happen. So it was really the lumber pile that kept me going. But it wasn't until after he died that I began to realize the deep way he was thinking about wood. And people just think wood is wood. It's something to make something out of. But he respected it as almost as a living being. And he worked with the wood. So it's been a learning experience for me. I wrote my book, Nature, Form, and Spirit, after he died. Mm-hmm. And I did research with my cousin for many years. And I learned all kinds of things. I'm still learning things about him. I'm just following in the footsteps. And
for those who are maybe not familiar with Japanese techniques and also the attitude of I think many Japanese woodworkers have, and especially your father and you. What is the philosophy with, because you are searching for something else, you don't just take any kind of wood and you cut it into planks and make a chair by the plan, but you start somewhere from a different point, no?
Well, my father was trained first as an architect before he went into furniture. So he had that knowledge of the strength of materials and the construction.
Statics and those kinds of things.
Yeah. I mean, he had a very, very strong sense and very, very keen sense of proportion. Mm-hmm. One of the interviews we did in Japan was with a Japanese architect, and he said he's the only person he knew that could see differences in levels of proportion and sizes of a millimeter from across a room. You know, he just had a sense of the proper size and shape that things could be. And when he was searching, it was mostly for tabletops that the free edge of, the natural shape of the wood comes out, but he had a sense that maybe it's because when he cut the wood, he also had in mind what that piece of wood was going to be, but he had a sense of which piece of wood would be proper for a certain purpose.
I think
that it's
called spatial intelligence, yes? Some people that are really good at it, that they, you know, yes. Like architects or sculptors,
yes.
They have intuitive yes. knowledge of that, what some people don't see, no? So
yes.
He has really strong abilities in that.
Yes, that's correct.
And? Sorry.
No, that's perfect. Thank you.
No, but from that, because as far, I think I read somewhere that he would take a piece of wood and from this, from the wood to wood to express what he has to say or what kind of furniture it should be, no?
Yes.
Because usually the people just said, okay, I need a stool, so you will take, okay, let me get this wood or this wood.
Mm-hmm.
But he was doing differently, no? Because he was selecting the
yes.
All the logs and everything, no?
Yes. It is a very long and complicated process. You start with a tree, you cut the tree, and then you have to dry it very carefully before you use it. And then you have to find the right piece of wood from that tree for a particular purpose. And it's a difficult process, especially with a client. I mean, you may think this is the right piece of wood for somebody, but they may not think so. I mean, nowadays people are much more, when my father was alive, he was much stronger personality than me.
Mm-hmm.
So if he would tell people that this is the right thing for them, and they would listen to him, and they say, okay, that's the right piece, if you say so. Nowadays, because I took over after my father died, and I was afraid the business would also die, I got very flexible. People would push me much further than I wanted to be pushed. So now I still have that habit. In fact, parents...
It's a man's world, though. You are a woman, you know? That's also different, no?
Yeah, but it's also kind of the way I was brought up. My parents were very strict, and I had to do what I was told. And then when I was working with my father, he said, you're too flexible. You're a pushover. You do what people want you to do, and that's the way I was brought up, you know? So... Yes, but maybe it's being a woman, too. They figure they can push us around more.
They try, at least. So out of that, but also his furniture, I know there are thousands of pieces, but it's by now it's got an iconic state, no? It's not only a furniture, it's a piece of art.
Now it is, yes. And that happened, I think, thanks to my father's last retrospective show, which was also his first retrospective, at the American Craft Museum in New York. The curator of that show was named Derek Ostergaard, and he's also on the film. But he was able to see my father's design methods and the way he worked in the context of other furniture designers. And in the museum, he put a chair. I mean, up until that point, we had 8 shows in Japan. And every time he had a show in Japan, he was very proud of those shows. But they were furniture shows. You know, they would be chairs and tables, and you would sit at them and decide whether you wanted to buy them or not by sitting on them. In the Full Circle show, the chair was stuck on a pedestal on the wall. The table was on a pedestal in the middle of a big space, and you couldn't touch it.
That's a different approach.
It's a very different approach. But
because
art? It was displayed as art rather than just furniture. And it was the beginning and it was also, the show came home, the last piece of furniture came home a week before my father passed away.
Mm.
So it was prophetically named Full Circle. He had done Full Circle, and we were worried because the so-called vintage pieces, at least I was a little bit worried, because people were selling secondhand Nakashima pieces and getting bigger and bigger money for them, and I thought they're going to put us out of business, but it's actually helped us.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my colleagues, I call them colleagues now because they've actually helped our business, are in the secondary market, and they will take the furniture that people have used and lived with and they will resell it, and they're getting lots of money for it. But it's also helped our business. We sell, you know, wholesale, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But people, and it's expensive to make things by hand, especially we design everything individually and cater to people's different wishes, and we actually lay out the room for them if they need to. So they get a lot of special services, and they we make things by hand. We're not very efficient. We do a lot of things very inefficiently. And so it's expensive because it takes a lot of manpower. But by contrast, the older pieces are very expensive, so our pieces are inexpensive by contrast, so we're grateful to that, the secondary market.
You're also doing the restoration work, right? Of the your father's pieces or anything?
Oh, no, just my father's pieces. No, if we did, no, we don't have. It's a very sensitive process. Yesterday we went to Golconde, and Loretta has taken it upon herself to refurbish the furniture in Golconde because it was there since 1939, I believe. And some of it is getting old and needs refinishing, and some of it's broken and needs fixing. And so she's taken it upon herself to refurbish the furniture, and she's hired this wonderful man from Oroville named Carlos. And he has done restoration work for museums, I think. So he's did a lot of research on the proper way to refinish. And it's not easy.
No,
he said the doors were getting so thin that if they kept setting them, they would disappear because they would be too thin and they would break. So he has found a material, two materials actually, that he uses according to the usage. Some like tabletops get hard usage, and the handrails on the stairways get hard usage. So he uses a harder finish there, and some of the places don't get used so hard, so he uses a different finish. But he's done a beautiful job, and restoration is tough.
It was, I think, restored 2 or 3 years back, no? Fully. Because I've seen some images. Wooden frames of the... I mean, your father supervised that first massive concrete structure, yeah?
Yes.
But I know that it was restored as far as 2 or 3 years back, no?
Oh, the architecture was restored, yes. No, the architecture looks very good. It's just the wooden furnishings inside that have not been done, and so...
Your father also did the wood, the furniture inside?
I believe so. And maybe it was a joint project with Samir, but I know my father did some of them.
I've seen the windows and some closets, and they're beautiful. Yeah,
Yeah, they're still in very good shape. It's just they needed a little polishing and sanding and fixing and re-caning. The cane is getting old and dirty and falling apart, so they're fixing all that. But it's still good.
George Nakashima, and also you are famous, so to speak, famous, but known here and in ashram, yeah? How about the native country, the place where he was born, how does it treat George?
Actually, my father was born in Seattle, Spokane, Washington, in Washington State. I don't know, my father did, as I said, 8 shows in Japan, and it was interesting, I guess. The war does different things to different people, but most of the people of his generation who were born in this country but incarcerated during the war didn't want to have anything to do with Japan. They didn't want to be associated with the enemy. My father embraced Japanese culture and embraced the Japanese aesthetic. And he, one of the interviews we did in Japan, one of the designers or architects, I forget which, was saying that my father embraced Japan so fully that he was more Japanese than the Japanese were.
It sometimes happens, yeah. But it's the roots, no? I mean, even if he was born in the States, but still it's the roots of something.
Yes, oh yes, definitely.
It's
and
genetic
he,
memory, which you cannot change it.
This is true.
Changing the country, right?
Yes, yes, no, that's very true. No, he felt very much associated with, he called himself a Japanese druid, I think. In Shinto, they don't exactly worship things, but they feel that there are spirits in everything in nature, and they should be respected. And so, and their architecture reflects that. They want to be part of the out of doors. They don't want to be shut in, like they do in some of the European countries. But he also worked in the office of Antonin Raymond in Tokyo in the 1930s. From 34 to 36, he worked in Japan. He developed a very strong friendship, and that's mentioned in the film also, with Junzo Yoshimura. And Yoshimura took him to a lot of old places. in Japan, where the tradition was still old and strong. And my father was just totally absorbed in that, and he carried that with him too, I think, all of his life.
That's nice, beautiful. It's getting late, yeah. Do you have a full program today?
Oh, not really, and I'm sorry we were so late.
Is there something you would like to share with us? And because I don't know much about you, I just admire the peace table. And a few pieces, and I admire the way how the Japanese or that artwork is actually really state of art. And you know that your father was a special man for sure.
Yes. Yes, he was, and the longer I live, the more special I realize he was. You know, when I was little, he was just my father. And then as I am growing older, I realize how special he was. Yeah, and I feel that... And I feel
also
it is...
So when the parents die, you realize, okay, that's what you inherit, that's what you learn. You know, there's also so many things, at least I realized for myself when my parents were dying, that after they left, okay, that is, you know, that's where we're coming from. So that's the thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. This is true, yes.
Yeah, and you probably do until we die.
Yes, this is true. Yes, and And as I feel not so much with my mother, she was not a very spiritual person, but with my father, I still feel like his spirit is guiding me. Maybe that's why I haven't spent that much time in the ashram either. He was very much guided by the mother in Sri Aurobindo, but he knew them. I didn't know them. I didn't meet them. My brother met the mother before she passed. But I never met the mother, and I certainly did not meet Sri Aurobindo. And I've tried to read. When we were staying in the ashram, we got to know Udar very well, and we would go listen to his reading of Savitri every morning, or afternoon it was, I can't remember. But we used to go every day to hear him recite Savitri, so it was very powerful.
Yeah, Savitri is a special thing, no?
Yeah. But there's so much to learn.
Yeah. It is actually more you're doing it than you realize it. So it's another universe and another universe, and this depth is like, we'll have a time for everything.
That's the trouble. But I guess...
You have any children?
I do. I have 4 children. I have 7 grandchildren.
Well, so you have people who will continue the work, no?
Well, I hope I will.
Any of them inclined to the your father's work?
Well, my oldest son is doing refinishing and repair work with us, and he wants to make Nakashima furniture, but he wants to make it different than we do. So, he's got his own operation.
Maybe he needs a life-changing experience.
Yes, he does. Yes, that's what I was meditating on while I was in the chamber this morning.
You cannot call it. It has to happen, though.
Yeah. And there's many times we also studied with a Zen Buddhist priest, and I wanted him to come and just do Zazen even for a week or two. And he said, no, he has to come. He has to want to come himself. So he never got there.
That is something you cannot really force him.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
But when it happens, it will happen. Some people wait for it almost until the end of the life, no?
Yes, and I named my son Satoru, which means Satori, enlightenment. So I'm still waiting.
How old is he now?
Oh, he's 50.
It might happen. To some people, it does happen in late age. Yeah.
Yes. And I have a daughter also who studied architecture, and she's working in Canada. Mm-hmm. And my 2 other sons are in medicine.
So half of them stays on the line of the, they stay with the legacy, the other they're trying to do something more.
Yes, but it's one of my sons who is a doctor, he studied art more than anybody else in the family. He was a pretty good artist. I thought maybe he would dual major in medicine and art, but he just did the medicine instead. But he has it. I think he has it somewhere.
He should do it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I never lived in the States, so I don't know, but as far as I know, it's pretty much people are tied up with everyday life to make the ends to meet.
Yes.
So it's kind of different versus Orville, where you, it's hardly to find a person who would do only one job. With that style, you have a possibility to express yourself with some kind of what you can do, or maybe the creative part or something else, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I remember when I was growing up, my father said, oh, the children in the ashram all speak 5 languages. You have to learn 5 languages. I'm still working on it.
Mira, thank you for today. Looking forward for the film. Today somewhere at 4 o'clock, I think, in Babišćate.
Yes.
In that new extension in Bharat Nivas, behind the auditorium.
Mm.
And tomorrow at Peace Table at 5:15, right?
Is that when it is?
That's when I scheduled
Okay, that's when you scheduled it. Okay, that's when it is then. Yeah, I think it'll work out just right. My husband is staying at the ashram tomorrow because they want to see the film there. Mm-hmm. And then he's coming to pick me up at 7:30, and then we go back to the States tomorrow night.
That's a very short visit, no?
Yes, it's too much too short.
Then you have to come again, no?
Thank you, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very
much.
Arigato. Doita shimashite. You do speak foreign languages.